aspects of Emerson's thought that require our consideration. This is, I think, perhaps the sixth generalization that I would like to offer, and it is one which has been of considerable interest and influence, and that is Emerson's view of history. Just as man makes nature and all the other aspects that we have discussed heretofore, so too man makes his own history. And by that, Emerson means that history doesn't come to us as anything fixed and permanent, but it is something that evolves in response to our own concerns, to our own interests, and to our own selectivity. History is part of an infinite past. The past cannot be measured, cannot be comprehended by any human mind or combination of human minds. So we select from that past only certain aspects, certain facts, which we subject to our attention, to our interest, and we give those past events a significance which otherwise it may not have. History is only that part of the past which is usable to us. And it depends upon us who are alive to select from that infinite past those events and those aspects which suit our interests and further our purposes. And the rest is forgotten. The rest is left in darkness. And it's a wide and deep darkness which engulfs everything that is ascribable to the past. The past, therefore, has no significance except that which I give it, that which we give it. Apart from what I or we give to it, it is nothing from the human point of view. For example, you give the Bible to someone who is illiterate, who is not concerned with the Bible. You give it to a pagan somewhere in the world, in Asia, in Africa, in Australia, anywhere. It is no more meaningful to him than if you were to hand to him a copy of the Manhattan telephone directory. It's nothing. Some object. It's an artifact from another civilization. It is not the Bible. Give the Bible to someone who comes to it with feelings, emotions, thoughts, which have been built up not merely by him, but by the generations in back of him, which he has assimilated. And this is not just a book. Then to him, it is what he would call the Bible, and give the word a special meaning. It has a special aura which no other book would have. History is therefore that part of the past which my present lights up. That part of the past which I select out of the infinite darkness and give it the kind of life that I wanted to have. And that's the only life that the past has. Let me read to you from Self-Reliance. Man is timid and apologetic. He is no longer upright. He dares not say, I think, I am, but quotes some saint or sage. He is ashamed before the blade of grass or the blowing rose. These roses under my window make no reference to former roses or to better roses. They are for what they are. They exist with God today. There is no time to them. There is simply the rose. It is perfect in every moment of its existence. Before a leaf bud has burst, its whole life acts. In the full-blown flower, there is no more. In the leafless root, there is no less. Its nature is satisfied, and it satisfies nature in all moments alike, as it has only a present. It exists only in the present. But man postpones, man remembers. He does not live in the present, but with reverted eye laments the past, or heedless of the riches that surround him, stands on tiptoe to foresee the future. He cannot be happy and strong until he too lives with nature in the present, above time. That is, while abstracting, the process of abstracting is important, as we've discussed it the other day, for actual living, for the enjoyment of life, for the feeling of life, one doesn't abstract, but one lives concretely, existentially, as it were, in the present moment, to squeeze out of it everything that it has to offer, without regard to the past, without regard to the future. Now, that present may include the past by way of enjoyment, but then I have made the past present by my enjoyment. To use again the example of the Bible, if I take the Bible into the present moment, I take it off the shelf. I haven't looked at it for months, for years. But if I make it present to me now, it is then the past, insofar as it is present, has a life, and it is lived in the present moment. This should be plain enough, yet see what strong intellects dare not yet hear God himself, unless he speak the phraseology of I know not what David or Jeremiah or Paul. We shall not always set so great a price on a few texts, on a few lives. We are like children who repeat by rote the sentences of grandfathers and tutors. As they grow older, of the men of talents and character they chance to see, painfully recollecting the exact words that these people spoke. Afterwards, when they come into the point of view with those who had uttered these sayings, they understand them and are willing to let the words go. For at any time, they can use words as good when occasion comes. If we live truly, we shall see truly. It is as easy for the strong man to be strong as it is for the weak to be weak. When we have new perceptions, we shall gladly disburden the memory of its hoarded treasures as old rubbish. When a man lives with God, his voice shall be as sweet as the murmur of the brook and the rustle of the corn. Let me give you an example from our religious traditions. A Christian who says, please try to follow me. I think it's these illustrations will probably bring home to you what Emerson, in this poetic way, tries to say, not merely in these passages that I read, but in many passages. The Christian says, when he does say it, Christ died for me. Now, it is not that Christ died centuries ago for other people. but that he died for me, if he says that, if he dies for me now, and not simply for the followers who lived at the time of Christ, the contemporaries of Jesus, then Christ lives for him now and has a meaning for him, a significance, now in the present. This, of course, is the Christian teaching. And unless the Christian has this thought, has this belief, and has these feelings, a feeling of come presence, he is at the crucifixion. He is there. He's contemporaneous with the event. He's contemporaneous with Christ. He's contemporaneous with the living and the dying presence of Christ. Then he is truly a Christian in the traditional sense of the term. This, of course, was the meaning of Good Friday and of Easter. The Jew has a similar feeling. At the Seder, Passover Eve, in the Haggadah, which he reads, he is required, it is stated, to think of himself, to see himself as one who participated in the Exodus from Egypt. Unless he can make that identification that he himself was in the Exodus from Egypt, unless he makes that identification, then the Seder is hardly more than a mumbo jumbo, as it becomes only a memorial service for a past event. It's like saying a Kaddish for something that is dead, that is gone. But the celebration has to be of an event that is happening now. That is, now we are moving from enslavement into freedom. We are making that passage from enslavement, from slavery to freedom. Unless he does that, he misses the whole point of the Passover celebration. And the same thing is true, say, of Pentecost. Unless he can identify himself as standing at the foot of Mount Sinai at the giving of the law, if it was given to others, it's no concern of his. But if he identifies himself as having been there, as being there now, it's an event that is happening now, that God is now giving him the law, the Torah. If he makes that identification, then he's truly participating, celebrating in an event which is significant for him. Now, this is what Emerson says in one way and another. The past has no life. It has no significance, except in the life and in the significance with which I infuse that past. It is dependent upon me. If I give it life, it lives. If I don't give it life, it is dead, and no more alive than the rest of the infinite dead that the past has absorbed and somehow assimilated to itself. I therefore make the Bible. I make Judaism. I make Christianity. It is dependent upon me, the living, not upon the dead. And this is true, of course, of all that stands as somehow remarkable in our culture, in our civilization. Plato's dialogues are absolutely meaningless, except for the people who read Plato, who work with Plato. Then they become living thoughts. It's not what Plato thought thousands of years ago that's important. What is important is that I think those thoughts. And without me, Plato is dead. As dead as a doornail. As dead as anything can be. As dead as a piece of wood. Goethe made a statement which has come down through the generations, which is typically Emersonian. Emerson says the same thing time and again. And that is that tradition cannot be inherited as if it were a piece of land. You can inherit a piece of land, you can inherit your parents' furnishings from the house. A father leaves such and such pictures, books, furniture to such a child and this to another child. But a tradition, anything that has to do with a spirit, cannot be inherited. It has to be worked for. It has to be won. It has to be, to use Goethe's expression, conquered. Otherwise, it becomes a burden on one's back. And the only thing to do with a burden is to try to disburden yourself, to get rid of it as soon as you can. But if it becomes part of you, if it is assimilated, and it's the only way that a tradition can be meaningful, then that tradition is significant, and the significance is what I give to it. I take something, but what I take is very small in comparison to what I give, because what I take is dead until I breathe my life, my breath, my spirit into it. T.S. Eliot's work on tradition is exactly derivative from Emerson. He says, for example, you ask yourself the question, what is the tradition of English poetry? Well, English poetry has literally tens of thousands of persons who have written poems. But how much of that becomes part of a living tradition? Each generation struggles with this question. The other day, a new Oxford Book of English Verse was published. There were previous editions, earlier years, selected by other people. Last week, there was published an Oxford Book of modern, more or less contemporary verse. Again, not the first by any means. What that means is that every few years, many people, have to struggle with what otherwise would be a sea of poets and poems and make a selection. And that selection is handed down from one to the other, constantly being revised. Every new edition, you see some poems thrown out, some poets thrown out, new ones being brought in. New poets are discovered. Old poets suddenly come to life. They had been discarded. But they suddenly become meaningful because of something that has developed in the contemporary scene that makes them quite different from what they had been thought of before. Emily Dickinson forces us to rethink the poems of John Donne, because the metaphysical poets, by reason of Emily Dickinson, take on a contemporaneity which they otherwise lacked. She brings metaphysical poetry suddenly before us as something interesting, even exciting, very valuable. This is a process that happens constantly, so that our traditions, T.S. Eliot argues, are only the selections that we make for a usable past in the present. And everything else falls into a kind of a cemetery. It's dead. You can go through any library and you will see books that haven't been taken out for years and years. We have the problem of our own Olin library with new books constantly coming in. And every now and then the librarians have to go through and find out which books can be placed in storage. They will not be burned. Someday somebody may want them. They will be rediscovered, some of them. But it may take generations, and in the meantime, nobody uses them. Whoever hears of many of the poets that at one time flourished Their poems were published and they made a little stir in their day. But they get lost in a deep and infinite past. And one can say the same thing of religions, and of art, and of almost every aspect, I suppose, of our culture. So each man is, as it were, a kind of a Frankenstein, a Baron Frankenstein who can create either a monster, as Frankenstein did, that can destroy him, can destroy his maker, or he can make a creature, a subperson, that will sustain and enhance the creator. And as we work with the past, we seek to make a creation that will enhance us. Otherwise, we are not concerned with the past. We look for an enrichment. We look for an enlargement of ourselves. The present isn't enough for us, because the present is a specious moment. It's gone as we think of it. As we utter a word, it is already assimilated to the past. So we try to bring into the present a past which will give the present a depth which it otherwise would lack. It's like listening to a symphony. Every note that you hear separated from the rest is not significant. But when you listen to the fourth movement, somehow or other, you're not listening to the first because you're listening to the fourth, and you're listening only to what is being played by the symphony orchestra there and then. But nonetheless, there's the magic, and it is a deep mystery that the mind somehow contains the first movement and the second movement and the third movement. They are somehow co-present with the present moment and eat their way into the fourth movement. And history plays this role for us. It's a kind of several movements of in the past, which, however, are in the present, without which the present would be only a cry and hardly more than a biological grunt, as it were. An animal grunt would have no meaning, no significance. But the human being looks for what is meaningful, for what is significant to him. Let me try to use some language of Emerson's from the essay on the Oversoul. This is at the end of the essay. Great is the soul and plain. It believes in itself. Before the immense possibility of man, all mere experience, all past biographies, however spotless and sainted, shrinks away. Before that heaven which our presentiments foreshow us, we cannot easily praise any form of life we have seen or read of. We not only affirm that we have few great men, but absolutely speaking, that we have none, that we have no history, no record of any character or mode of living that entirely contents us. The saints and the demigods whom history worships, we are constrained to accept with a grain of allowance. Though in our lonely hours we draw a new strength out of their memory, yet pressed on our attention as they are by the thoughtless and the customary, they fatigue and invade. The soul gives itself alone, original and pure, to the lonely, original and pure, who on that condition gladly inhabits, leads, and speaks through it. Then is it glad, young, and nimble. It is not wise, but it sees through all things. It is not called religious, but it is innocent. It calls the light its own and feels that the grass grows and the stone falls by a law inferior to and dependent on its nature, on the nature of the soul. Behold, it says, I am born into the great, the universal mind. I, the imperfect, adore my own perfect. I am somehow receptive of the great soul, and thereby I do overlook the sun and the stars, and feel them to be the fair accidents and effects which change and pass, so come I to live in thoughts and act with energies which are immortal, thus revering the soul and learning, as the ancient said, that its beauty is immense. Man will come to see that the world is the perennial miracle which the soul works, and be less astonished at a particular wonder. He will learn that there is no profane history, that all history is sacred, that the universe is represented in an atom, in a moment of time. He will weave no longer a spotted life of shreds and patches, but he will live with a divine unity. It's a beautiful passage, and what you get out of it is the feeling that Emerson had for the immensity of man. Everything seems to focus on the spirit, or on the soul, as he calls it, of man, without which nothing would be alive, nothing would be awake, nothing would be vocal, nothing would be beautiful, nothing would be good, nothing would be holy. The world would be completely empty of any meaning, of any significance, except for the fact that the human soul is there and works its magic, its mysterious magic, on the world and on itself. This is a very telling and very famous passage from the Essay on Civilization. Now, that is the wisdom of a man in every instance of his labor, to hitch his wagon to a star. This is where the phrase comes from. And see his chore done by the gods themselves. That is the way we are strong, by borrowing the might of the elements, the forces of steam, gravity, galvanism, light, magnets, wind, fire, serve us day by day and cost us nothing. Let me explain this. There are several elements. I want to go on with this passage. But first, this element in it is, how does man achieve the mastery over nature? We talked about man making nature. How does he do it? He does it by using the energies of the world, by taking coal, making energy out of it. He can use water to create energy, oil, petroleum, to make energy. He uses wind. He uses all of the elements that play in the world, in the universe. The force of gravity, fire, steam, electricity, magnetism. In this way, he hitches his wagon to a star. He doesn't hitch himself to the wagon, which of course is true of a primitive civilization, where man does all the work. Nothing does the work for him. He is nature, and this is all that he seems to have. What he doesn't do doesn't get done. He cannot depend on anything, on anybody. But in civilization, where man is aware of his power, he hitches his wagon to a star, to the elements. The stars do the work for him. The universe does the work for him. And of course, in our day, we see more of that than Emerson was able to see or even to foresee. Our astronomy, he wrote, I'm going on with this passage. There are other aspects that I want to mention here. Our astronomy is full of examples of calling in the aid of these magnificent helpers. Thus, on a planet as small as ours, the want of an adequate base for astronomical measurements is early felt, as for example, in detecting the parallax of a star. But the astronomer, having by an observation fixed the place of a star, by so simple an expedient as waiting 6 months and then repeating his observation, contrived to put the diameter of the Earth's orbit, say 200 millions of miles, between his first observation and his second. And this line afforded him a respectable base for his triangle. All our arts aim to win this advantage, this advantage. We cannot bring the heavenly powers to us, but if we will only choose our jobs and directions in which the heavenly powers travel, they will undertake them. But if we will only choose our jobs and directions in which the heavenly powers travel, they will undertake them with the greatest pleasure. It is a peremptory rule with them that they never go out of their road. We are dapper little busybodies and run this way and that way, but they swerve never from their foreordained paths, neither the sun nor the moon, nor a bubble of air, nor a mote of dust. That is what we try to do, is to find out how they move, how the elements work, what is their nature, what is their direction. And then we hitch our wagon to them and move with them. And then he goes on, and as our handiworks borrow the elements, so all our social and political action leans on principles. As just as it's true of physical nature, so it is true of moral nature. It is the principles that are operative. Just as the laws are operative in physical nature, so we try to discover what the moral principles are that are operative in our moral relations, moral and political. To accomplish anything excellent, the will must work for Catholic and universal ends. As if you work for a selfish end, for a narrow end, then your horizon is limited. Nothing will work with you. You yourself will have to do the work. But if you work with a principle, an obvious example from our own day would be, say, Martin Luther King, to give you an example. I could pick any number of others. But from our own contemporary history, he was great, he was effective, because he, as it were, hitched his wagon to a principle of equality, the principle of justice. If he had struggled only for himself, who would have heard of him? He would have been nobody we could possibly talk about. But as soon as he was able to discover a fundamental principle, he discovered that there were millions of people who worked with him. All of nature seemed to cooperate to work with him. Nothing seemed to stand in his way. He was willing to go to jail. He was willing to be insulted, to be humiliated, but he overcame because the principle worked with him. We shall overcome. He did overcome. Dr. Schweitzer would be another example from our contemporary scene. As soon as he was able to attach himself to a principle of the doctor as a man of service, and nothing else but service. Service for those who needed him most, needed him desperately. When he went to Lamarine in Senegal, he discovered that the whole world was interested in what he was doing. He changed the whole concept of missionary work. Medical missions were developed. All other kinds of missions were developed. Our Peace Corps, of course, owes a debt to Dr. Schweitzer. Vista owes a debt to Dr. Schweitzer. That this is what Emerson is saying here, that the same idea that works in physical nature for man must work in the moral realm. To accomplish anything excellent, the will must work for Catholic and universal ends. A puny creature, walled in on every side, unless above himself he can erect himself, how poor a thing is man. But when his will leans on a principle, when he is the vehicle of ideas, he borrows the omnipotence of the ideas. Gibraltar may be strong, but ideas are impregnable, and bestow on the hero their invincibility. It was a great instruction, said a saint in Cromwell's War, it was a great instruction that the best courages are but beams of the Almighty. That is, whenever a man has courage, the courage of his convictions, fighting for a great principle. It's as if God were behind them. And of course, this is what frequently you feel is being said in the Bible. It's the great belief that one is identified with a principle, and God seems to fight on his side. Hitch your wagon to a star. Let us not fag in paltry works which serve our pot and bag alone. Let us not lie and steal. No, God will help us then. We shall find all their teams going the other way. Charles's Wain, the Great Bear, Orion, Leo, Hercules, every god will leave us. Work rather for those interests which the divinities honor and promote: justice, love, freedom, knowledge, utility. These are traits and measures. The true test of civilization is not the census, not the size of cities, nor the crops, no, but the kind of man the country turns out. Well, that, I hope, gives you some idea of this aspect of Emerson's thought, what he means by his seeming belittling of history. He does it only, of course, the extreme position he sometimes seems to take is because he's such a great artist. The only way he can convey his point is by hitting the reader and waking him up. And he does this with continuous blows. He tries to teach the lesson that everything seems to move ultimately from the center which I have in me. There's no substitute for that. Everything must be generated from my inside outward, including all of the aspects of civilization, all of the aspects of our culture, and, of course, all of the aspects of what we profess to be our morality. Now, if I may try to bring Emerson to a conclusion, I'm not going to be able to do it today. I thought I would, but part of Friday I will still need to devote to Emerson to complete this analysis. I think if I may at this point in the 10 minutes that we have left, try to bring to a focal point what we've been saying from different approaches. I would say that all of Emerson seems to be based on a fundamental belief, and this is the main lesson that he tried to teach, and that is the infinite worth of the human being. The infinite worth, and if only man could realize his potentiality, his infinite dignity, his power and his dignity. Emerson, in his day, saw the danger in democracy, just as de Tocqueville in the 1830s saw that the individual may be crushed by the mob, by the weight of votes, where there is a system of universal suffrage, by the force of conformity, where men will simply go on from generation to generation, as they seem to have done in the Dark Ages for some centuries. Nothing seemed to happen. Human beings fell into a kind of a pattern, into a rut, until something took them out of that rut. Emerson believed that each person has in himself infinite possibilities, but he fails to develop them. And he fails to develop them because of his eagerness to act as a member of his group, which sometimes leads him to act as a member of his mob, or because of indolence, laziness. You get into a habit, into a status quo, and you're comfortable with it. or because of mean ambitions, because of avarice, cupidity, or because of a fear of insecurity. One doesn't know what the next day may bring if one takes a step which is a little different from the steps one had taken before. And so prudence, timidity, laziness, avarice, cowardice, all of these aspects of our lives seem to often stand in the way of our winning the kingdoms which we could win for ourselves if we weren't hampered. One of his diary entries for the year 1840, typical of many of his statements, is this: "In all my lectures, I have taught one doctrine, namely, the infinitude of the private man." That, I think, is a fair statement of the central lesson which Emerson tried to teach. In this, I think, he was a direct descendant of Socrates, of the Stoics, and of our own biblical tradition. And like Socrates and the Stoics and the Bible, Emerson saw both a separation and a connection, a very intimate connection, between the inner man and the outer man, between what he would call the reality and what he might call the appearance, the inner world and the external world. And that those two worlds were connected by the moral law, a law which both separates and connects the two worlds. And it is by this connection that man makes himself, that he makes his destiny, and that he makes his world. The moral law operates in that way, that what the man makes of himself in the inner part of his being will in some way become true of the outer man too. Man is therefore a sub-creator under God the Creator. And he makes a world which is, as he himself has put it, his sub-person. Man is therefore truly the center of the universe which God has made, exactly as man is in Genesis, where God finished his work of creation with the creation of man. One of the passages from Emerson: "O rich and various man, thou palace of sight and sound, carrying in thy senses the morning and the night, and the unfathomable galaxy, in thy brain the geometry of the city of God, and in thy heart the realms of right and wrong." Man is therefore the being of infinite capacity, the creature exactly who, as in Psalm 8, which we've mentioned time and again, was made by God to be only a little less than God himself. Or the being, man, the being who, to whom there was the paean sung by the chorus in the Antigone that we discussed. Great and wondrous being, great and wondrous man. Now, no one in literature or in philosophy gave more meaning to this idea than did Emerson. And the impression and the influence of his statement of this central thought is one that no one can measure, and I certainly wouldn't try to measure it. Well, when we come back on Friday, I will conclude this discussion.